Hello, I'm Shirley Joseph. This is number 0394, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0394. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Olivia LaPointe, a rocket scientist and author of Mathophobia. Although she loved mathematics, it didn't necessarily come easy for her.
I failed algebra, I failed geometry, I failed calculus, and I failed chemistry. People think that once they fail a course, once they do poorly, they are not able to do well in courses, and that is the complete opposite. I am the living example that you can fail at something, but it's only if you realize what you can do differently and change the way that you're thinking that will allow you to succeed. And for me, I found a teacher that was willing to help me understand how to read mathematics as a language, and that passion of mathematics and science came out again.
Sports expert Tony Cotillo on Major League Baseball's plan for rule changes.
We're talking about a sport whose attendance is at an all-time high. We're not talking about the NFL, who's looking at a 16% rate in drop-off of attendance. But again, they're always looking for ways to speed the game up because they do have some of the newcomers that say it is too slow, it needs to be sped up. And unfortunately, I think they really have to be careful because if you start changing these rules, you change the whole methodology of the game.
Spunk Burke, author of The Gig Solution. He has ideas to help baby boomers with gainful employment because it can be tough for them.
We hear about labor statistics and full employment, but it doesn't really reflect the plight of people over the age of 50. I'm talking about business professionals who, over the age of 50, who happen to lose their job, have a very, very difficult time finding a comparable job. And so they may go months without being able to even be interviewed. And if they are lucky enough to land a job, it's typically underemployment, if you will. It's less of a job than they used to have, and certainly a lot less pay.
And there's lots and lots. Lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0394 was Shirley Joseph, co-host and producer of The Cackle, heard on CKVL Montreal 100.1 FM, Thursdays at 9 p.m. And Shirley also runs the Facebook group Black Canadian Content Creators. Thank you very much, Shirley, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Also, the Stuff File program is a listener-supported radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Be a patron of the show and find out about our rewards program. I'd also love to hear your thoughts about the Stuff File program and even some of your ideas for rewards. So come on, participate and join us for the ride. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram and be part of the Stuff File Nation. Okay, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, a self-righteous woman slammed into a chicken truck twice because she does not like the fact that people are eating living things. 26-year-old Judith Moriah Armstrong of Georgia was arrested after she crashed into the truck that was carrying live chickens before fleeing the scene. The unidentified truck driver was traveling west on Highway 72 when a four-door red car hit his truck twice. The truck driver called the police when the car fled. Madison County deputies found the vehicle's license plate in the debris that was left in the crash. That is how they were able to trace the owner of the car, who matched the description given to them by the truck driver. Now, during the interrogation, Armstrong admitted to being involved in an accident and said that she fled for fear of losing her license. She also told the officers that she hit the truck because she is a vegan. Police said that Armstrong appeared to be drunk. She denied having alcohol before the crash. She claimed she took a couple of shots when she got home. She was tested for alcohol and blew a .089, which is above the legal limit. Armstrong now faces charges of hit and run, aggressive driving, driving under the influence, and obstruction. Okay, first of all, this is one of those rare stories that we've had on this show involving someone doing something stupid with a vehicle who actually has a valid driver's license. So kudos to her for that. I mean, so many of these stories have someone with a suspended license. And second, it was interesting that she hadn't lost her license, but she did lose her license plate. That's how she was caught. That's irony. And finally, there are some vegans out there who really, really, really need to chill just a bit. I'm just saying. Okay, a Chinese martial artist shared video of he and his students taking repeated blows to the groin as means of promoting his unusual form of kung fu. Master Wei Yaobin, known as the Iron Crotch Kung Fu Master, ouch, appeared in a video alongside some of his students taking strong kicks to the groin, as well as being hit in the privates with objects including bricks and a battering ram. Double ouch. Wei claims his form of kung fu can help men overcome erectile dysfunction and premature ejaculation. Wow, you'd think it would do just the opposite. The master said he previously only taught his form of kung fu, which he has been practicing for 10 years, in the city of Liaoyang to family friends, but he is now seeking to make his iron crotch methods more widespread. We want it to be more popular and accepted by the public, Wei told Asia One. Yeah, well, good luck with that. I mean, how does one even come up with these ideas? What's it like in R&D when they're working out the kinks in their new system? I mean, that really takes... Oh, never mind. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a lonely Japanese man who amassed more than 6 tons of porn died when a huge pile of magazines fell on top of him. And even more tragically, the man's body was only discovered 6 months later when the landlord entered the flat to find out why the rent had not been paid. That's a pretty patient landlord, by the way, waiting 6 months, don't you think? The lowly death of the 50-year-old man, who was identified only as Joji, was revealed by a member of the cleaning team who said his company had been hired to remove the magazines discreetly in a way that would not be noticed by neighbors and the man's family to save them from the shame. It was unclear if he had suffered a heart attack and fallen into the stacks of magazines, which had then fallen on top of him, or whether he had been crushed by the mass of paper. Every space of the flat was filled with piles of magazines, which were also stacked on tables and on shelves. At the time of his death, the collection weighed in at 6 metric tons. That's 13,228 pounds. That's a lot of porn. That's a lot of anything, actually. Mothers around the world will share this story as a cautionary tale. They'll be telling their sons for years to come about how porn will be the death of you. Never mind the old standby of going blind. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? A recent People magazine article touched on the women depicted in the historical drama Hidden Figures. Those women were pioneers at NASA, paving a way for many to follow. Women like Olympia Lapointe, who began working as a rocket scientist for Boeing in 1998 at the age of 21. Her early life at Boeing was not unlike those of the early women at NASA. Olympia is currently a college math professor and motivational speaker. She is also the author of Mathophobia, and she joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Olympia.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. I'm wondering...
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I'm wondering, since you went into Boeing and you went into NASA, I mean, we're now just learning, because of this movie, we're now just learning the story of these women from NASA. How early along did you know about these women? I'm assuming you knew about them before the rest of us did.
It's very fascinating. The people that hired me knew about these individuals. I was such a young person. I was 21 years old, and I was so excited to enter science. But I didn't have the background and the knowledge of these individuals until maybe a couple of years later after I started. And it was the people that brought me into the company that knew about these women. And it is because of Katherine Johnson, because of the other women in Hidden Figures, is what allowed me to be able to make my mark in science.
Now, I understand that math always interested you as a child, but just because it did doesn't necessarily mean it was easy for you.
I always loved mathematics, and I'm so happy you asked that question. I loved mathematics, but I remember going to a field trip at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory here in Pasadena, California, and I saw these big engines and jets and rockets, and I told myself I want to be just like these rocket scientists. But I failed algebra, I failed geometry, I failed calculus, and I failed chemistry. And it is so fascinating. People think that once they fail a course, once they do poorly, they are not able to do well in courses. And that is the complete opposite. I am the living example that you can fail at something, but it's only if you realize what you can do differently and change the way that you're thinking that will allow you to succeed. And for me, I found a teacher that was willing to help me understand how to read mathematics as a language. And that passion of mathematics and science came out again and allowed me to be able to transfer all of my knowledge into an area which brought such success. So I'm very thankful that I learned through my own experiences, and I captured these in my book, Mathophobia. And I share about my own experiences, how I failed all these courses and how I define there's four people that we all fall into. There's Quincy the Quitter, there's Donna the Overdoer, there's Samuel the Struggler, and then there's Crystal the Criticizer, and this is all what we fall into, the trap, the mental trap that we fall into when we fail at something, when we do not realize that we have a way to always succeed.
Were you one of those four yourself, and if so, which one, or are you a combination of more than one?
Oh my God, I was all of them. I was all of them, and I have to laugh because I was all of them. In high school, I was Quincy the Quitter. In college, I was Donna the Overdoer. In graduate school, I was Crystal the Criticizer. Yes, I was Samuel the Struggler when I didn't wear my glasses, when I was in mathematical lectures. So it was a range of all of them, and we each fall into these categories.
You say your passion is mathematics. What is it about mathematics that you were so passionate about as a child? What was that aha moment for you when you said, you know, I love this because?
I grew up in a very dysfunctional world. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. There was gang chaos, violence. Our mother did her best to try and shield us from that, but we still were affected by what happened and what we saw in front of our eyes. And what I really truly appreciate about mathematics is that it was the one thing for me that allowed me to find structure and boundaries and something to hold on to that would always tell me the truth. And when I studied mathematics, it was like an escape for me because it allowed me to be able to see that there was always an answer. And it was always going to be in a way, if I really used every single resource that I had, it was going to allow me to find an answer to a problem that would always live forever. And so the reason why I always loved math was because it always showed me the truth.
Now, there are often obstacles in the way of people of color who want to succeed in one way, shape, or form. Some of those obstacles we put up ourselves. By that, I mean sometimes well-meaning family members try to talk you out of doing things because they feel the struggle might be too difficult or the road too long and treacherous to journey upon. Was everyone in your corner when you said, I want to go into mathematics, or did you have even detractors in your own family?
It's interesting. I love the fact of I am a first. I am actually the first in my family to have a college degree, a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, advanced degrees in mathematics. And I'm still the only person. And I had to realize that my family, although they were loving and caring, they did not completely understand the power of an education. My mother did. And she was the one who encouraged me, no matter what, to complete my degrees and to finish and to stick it out. But other family members didn't have that necessity in their being. And we each have different things that we have to do and so passionate about doing in life. And for me, it was my education. And I had to come to a realization early in my life that sometimes I could not depend on some of the closest family members to me, but rather I had to find mentors who were completely aligned with what it is that I saw for myself. And I had to find these individuals who were willing to help me fulfill the vision that I had for my own life. And sometimes those people that we find are not family members, but they're people that are divinely sent to us to help us accomplish what it is that we're sent to do.
Now, your book, Mathophobia, was there a point in your life, in your career, as I mentioned in the introduction, you worked at Boeing, you worked at NASA, you're now a college math professor and a motivational speaker, you've done TED Talks. Was there a moment when you said, I've got to write this book, and I'm writing this book for whom?
I wrote it actually for adults. I wrote it for adults to help their kids in mathematics. And I realized that when I wrote the book Mathophobia, it was when I started teaching part-time as a mathematics professor, and I realized that most of the people that were in my classes were returning students who were adults who faced a very difficult time in their life earlier where they had struggled with mathematics, and they carried that fear with them, and they didn't realize that they were also spreading it to their own children. So when I wrote the book Mathophobia, I was really concerned about giving this information to the parents who could then change the way that they would interact and inspire their own children so their children could be armed with the information to continuously succeed no matter what challenge was in front of them. And so it's so interesting because the book was written for kids, but who buys it are the parents, and it's not only the parents that are transformed, it's the kids that are transformed, and whole families are being transformed. And that is what I was most amazed to see.
I'm sure that there's some aha moments for the parents as well, thinking back to their own days of learning mathematics.
I remember I gave a lecture, and it was over at the California Science Center, and it was back in, I believe it was around 2008. And I remember giving a lecture, and one of the parents in the course came up to me crying. And at that moment in time, I looked and I thought, why is she crying? And I found out the parent was crying because she was so impacted by what it was that was being said, which was, her experience traumatized her with her particular math teacher. And she was surprised to find out that it were parents, math teachers, and school systems that actually spread mathophobia. So once we actually changed the way that each one of these particular entities transfer information, that actually ends the math fear. So she was completely shocked and crying, and I thought that was just like a one-time situation. But it was fascinating because years passed, and more people would come up crying afterwards, just completely moved, because they realized that they had the ability to change the way that they were thinking about not only their own success, not only in mathematics, but their own way that they solved problems on this planet. And it was an empowering thing, and I was just so honored to usher this information. And it led me to end up creating the content of my TED Talk, Reprogramming Your Brain to Overcome Fear, which is seen by, it's close to 1 million people now, and it's the same content that's in the Mathophobia book, which is changing the way which we think, and it's a type of what I call self-directed neuroplasticity, the ability to take our own thoughts and reshape our brain in a way where it unleashes its power to change our lives.
Do you think we've reached a point now where it's easier, especially for young girls, to get into the math field, which is at one point considered a man's world, a man's domain? Is it easier today than it was before, and is there still a ways to go?
There's still a ways to go. When I first started in 20, oh gosh, I started studying mathematics at the college level, and that was back, 25 years ago. And I was one of the very few women in this world. Back then, I remember in 1998, I remember stepping into a room where there would be 200 scientists, and I was the only woman. And I remember looking around thinking, what is this? and it has become a little better. If I would say that statistic, if I were to walk into that same type of room now, maybe over 20 years later, if I walk into that same room, if there's 200 men there, you'd probably be looking at a good, probably six women. Not one, but six. And so the reason why I think we have more to go is that we do have that ability to inspire more women to go into the science field. And that's what I love doing about right after the Hidden Figures movie came out, is that there is now an emphasis understanding how important science, technology, engineering, and mathematics are. And that's the STEM emphasis. And I'm so happy to be able to present STEM education to people so they realize how powerful it is, not only changing our own individual lives, but changing the lives of the country as a whole.
The book is called Mathophobia. It's written by Olympia LaPointe. And people can go to her website, olympialapointe.com. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I want to discuss a little further the comparisons between your life and what goes on in the movie Hidden Figures, but we'll save that for our Patreon patrons on an after podcast. I thank you very much, Olympia, for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Olympia LaPointe, author of Mathophobia. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is number 0394, and you'll find links to Olympia's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. And Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear more of Olympia as a Patreon reward. Just go to our Patreon page and become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And just a quick reminder, the month of March features many in the podcast community getting together to tout their favorite shows. They're asking you to do the same. List the shows you like to listen to on social media with the hashtag TryPod. That's TryPod. I'll give you my list right now. Every Friday with Dan and Olivia featuring Dan Miles and Olivia Dabo. It's always great listening. Give it a listen and have a little fun along the way. The Spoon with Robbie Rist, Tom Bowers, and Chris Jackson. A very irreverent show that's on each and every week. That's a lot of fun. There's Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin. The David Feldman Show. He's a stand-up comedian who has his own podcast. The Herd with Colin Cowherd for you sports fans. Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast. The Sound Off Podcast with Matt Kundel for anybody who's interested in the radio biz and the podcast field itself. And The Larry Miller Show. That's just eight of them off the top of my head. So what's your list? Share them online and get the podcast word out there. Remember, use the hashtag TryPod.
A message from the American Podcast Council.
You and I know why podcasting is so wonderful, but in a recent survey, 45% of Americans indicated they're unaware of the term podcasting. Think about it. 45%. People just like you, living unaware. It's as if the term podcasting was just a word, like folgenblurbel, or mockingturf, or schleen. People in your community need help. All this month, we want you to find a friend, a relative, a curious stranger. Show them how to try podcasts. Then share your story on something called Twitter with the hashtag TryPod. That's TryPod. Together, we can delete podcast unawareness. Won't you help? That's TryPod.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the proposed changes to the rules of Major League Baseball. Plus, we'll learn about some job ideas For the baby boomers out there, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, we have a couple of stories dealing with people who clearly have issues. Number one, 21-year-old Thomas Pinson was arrested in St. Petersburg, Florida in January and charged with domestic battery for roughing up his mother, even though, presumably lovingly, as he had her full name tattooed on his chest. Wow. And speaking of being on the delusional train, literally, story number two, police arrested a 22-year-old knife-wielding man in the restroom on a train in Dusseldorf, Germany in January. The man, naked, appeared quite annoyed at being hassled and did not have a ticket to ride. Of course. I mean, where would he keep it? And said that he was using the knife to shave his genital area because he was not welcomed at home. So, does that mean a clean-shaven genital area would make him welcome at home? And if that's true, what does that say about his home life? And still with nakedness, if there's one thing dogs do not do, it is climb trees. That is why it seems odd that a Mississippi man would climb a tree to look for his lost dog. Odder still is the fact that he did it naked. But then again, who knows what is normal in Mississippi? The Union County Sheriff's Office said that Shane Treadaway was looking for his lost dog when he climbed on top of a tree. At some point, Treadaway fell and ended up hanging upside down from the tree. Police do not know how Treadaway lost all of his clothes. And after 4 hours, that's right, 4 hours of hanging from the tree, Treadaway's girlfriend began looking for her lost boyfriend. She was shocked to find him hanging upside down from the tree. Treadaway was taken to the Tupelo Hospital. Police are still investigating the incident. Yeah, but in the meantime, is anyone still looking for the dog? According to a court document, an Arizona woman who suspected her boyfriend was having an affair shot him 7 times while he slept at a Scottsdale home. Miraculously, the man survived. The victim said he woke up believing he had heard fireworks before feeling excruciating pain and realizing he had been shot. He was rushed to the hospital with a gunshot wound to his penis, 2 gunshot wounds to his scrotum, and a gunshot wound to his neck, 1 to his upper back and left thigh. 53-year-old Della Flores was arrested and booked into jail on 1 count of first-degree attempted murder and 1 count of aggravated assault. Well, ladies, assuming everything is still working, you know he's available. Eesh. Let me start off this next story by telling you what 43-year-old Christopher Huppman told a judge. He said, "I have always been on the side of the law." Well, that might not be so accurate. Huppman, a bail bondsman in Cole Township, Pennsylvania, was in court to answer charges that he used a fake name to buy handguns and to get a permit for them. Police say his real name is Buckley, and under that name, he is also a convicted felon, and thus it's a felony for him to possess firearms. That's not the only charge, though. It seems Huppman married his wife's daughter shortly after she turned 18 without dissolving his prior marriage, the girl's mother says, so he's charged with bigamy, too. Huppman pleaded for the judge to release him since he says hundreds of clients out on bail would run buck wild if he wasn't available to supervise them. The judge set his bail at $300,000 cash only, which Huppman can't afford, so he's still in jail. Well, he's no Dog the Bounty Hunter, but he does have the dog part down, doesn't he? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's the latest case of a brain-dead moron criminal who gets caught because he can't stay away from social media. A suspect has been arrested in connection with a fire that burned the Sherbrooke County Clubhouse in Lake Worth, Florida. Investigators ruled it an arson. The fire caused more than $800,000 in damage, according to Palm Beach County Fire Rescue investigators. Tips from the public helped investigators identify and arrest a suspect. The Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office said several witnesses interviewed claimed they received Snapchats from 25-year-old Anthony Wayne Stowers, there's that middle name Wayne again, in which he made comments about starting a structure fire. One Snapchat, according to investigators, showed Stowers walking away from a two-story building that was on fire. Stowers is facing one count of second-degree arson. Unfortunately, they can't charge him with being an idiot. Ah, yes, social media. Law enforcement's best friend. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Major League Baseball wants to change some of the rules of the game. To talk about the proposed alterations to the Boys of Summer, sports expert Tony Cotillo is back on the program. He joins us on the line from Philadelphia. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us.
As always, I'd love to be on.
People often say the old saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Is baseball broke? Is that why people are thinking rules need to be changed?
I honestly don't think so. I mean, we're talking about a sport whose attendance is at an all-time high. We're not talking about the NFL, who's looking at a 16% rate and drop off of attendance. But again, they're always looking for ways to speed the game up because they do have some of the newcomers that say it is too slow, it needs to be sped up. And unfortunately, I think they really have to be careful, because if you start changing these rules, you change the whole methodology of the game.
It's almost like short attention span theater. They're concerned about those who are too busy looking down at their phones in the stands and that kind of thing.
You're absolutely right. I mean, baseball is a three-hour event. It's always been a three-hour event until the end of time. So let's just let it go. Let's play for 3 hours. We know what's going to happen. And you're right, with the constant age of technology, people are going to the game more as a social event than actually watch the game in general. So they're hoping maybe they can squeak this one by.
Now, one of the things that we know as far as the proposed rule changes are concerned is that they won't go into effect in the 2017 season because the players' union didn't agree on the rules. But I understand the league, Major League Baseball, would be able to arbitrarily make these changes if they wanted to in 2018.
Yes, that is correct. So they just brought these proposed changes February 7th of this year, and they're continuing to talk about them because they have to have the proper number of votes, obviously, and because of the season coming up in 2017 so close, it wouldn't be enough to get everybody on board with it in order to go forward. So, but yes, they can go in 2018.
Now let's talk about the rules that they actually want to change. No more intentional walks is one of them, right?
Yes, and that's a very interesting one, because what they basically want to do is they want to take an intentional walk sign from the dugout, whether it be a manager, another coach, or even another player for that instance, and they want to take away the four pitches and just give one sign and the guy gets first base. But unfortunately, if you look back at the history of the game, a lot of different things can happen for the four-pitch sequence. You don't necessarily have to do all four pitches. Maybe it could be a wild pitch. Maybe the pitcher and the catcher aren't on the same page. So you're taking that element out of the game, which I think is a mistake.
Plus, there's also the added situation of, because most of the times when people have an intentional walk, there's already somebody on base.
That is true.
Depending if they're not already on first, let's say they're on second base, and they're a power hitter, and they're afraid that, you know, even a deep single would score the run. Just intentionally walking somebody by saying, okay, you go to first without the four pitches, prevents somebody from stealing third, for instance.
Exactly. That's what I mean. It takes so much strategy out of the game, and a strategy that has been defined several times and mastered by a lot of people over the years. So you're taking away a lot of knowledge from this game just by certain instances like that. And let's not forget, even if you want to bunt, I mean, people think that just because the first intentional pitch, they have to continue with the next three. Everybody seems to forget that. I mean, they can intentional pitch one, two, after that, they can start the count again. It's up to them. So it's a shame that they're actually looking at this, but I honestly think this one is going to pass.
I've actually, in the past, many, many years ago, especially with some of the bigger players, and when I mean bigger, I'm talking taller, I've actually seen people
Right.
reach out and take a swing at a at a pitch that was intended to be an intentional pitch.
Absolutely, and that's the thing. I mean, there's so many different things. When you think about the size bats that these players use, I mean, you're going to have a guy up there with 38, 39, 40-inch bat, per se, and you're right. As long as they don't step on a plate, they just swat at it. I mean, that falls in play. We've seen it 100 times. You know, it could be the pitcher and catcher not on the same sign. You get the intentional walk sign, and unfortunately, the pitcher puts it right over plate. We've seen that happen. And to your point, if the guy's on second, well, maybe he can make it home or a wild pitch. So many different things and different elements of that rule that would have to be adjusted. So we'll see how it goes.
One of the other rules they want to change, extra innings with a runner on second base.
That hits me hard there. That really does. And you know, the funny thing about that is, if people are familiar, this is an international softball youth league rule. And it's really a shame that I still can't believe that we're actually considering this, because think about the Game 7 of the World Series it went in the extra innings. Think about how it would have been if they would have been able to put the guy on second base to start the inning in the top of the 10th. I mean, I just never heard of such a thing. I really think they're looking at this too closely. They really are.
Well, could there be a hybrid of this rule? Because, you know, when I saw this rule mentioned, it made me think of the reminiscent of the hockey shootout rule to end games that go into overtime or go into a tie at the end of regulation time and the five-minute overtime period. I'm just wondering, could this rule be a hybrid to eliminate what you just described? In other words, it can work in the regular season, but in the playoffs, the game has to go to whenever it ends the way it always has, which is the way it does play out in hockey.
I honestly think that either way you use this rule, it becomes incredulous. And only for the simple fact that, you know, you can change strike zones. Listen, if you want to change strike zones, you want to say another rule that they're proposing is above the kneecap instead of below the kneecap. If you want to do something like that, I think that doesn't alter the game so much. But when you're talking about starting, giving guys an advantage right away, and again, you're giving the one team an advantage right off the bat, at least in hockey, when they have the shootout, it goes back and forth. Now, I don't know, per se, if the rule's going to say, if you score, is it going to be like football? If you score a field goal, then, you know, if you score a run, is the other team going to have a chance to tie the game? So is it going to end just like that? There's so many different variations of the rule. But I just think that simple rule is taken way too much away from the game. I really do.
Well, how do you feel about the other rules they want to change? And that is the amount of the trips to the mound for the manager and the batting and the pitching coach, rather.
I think that stuff like that, I think, is absolutely, it's very justified, because that can become somewhat of a nuisance. And let's face it, the one thing that a lot of people are missing, too, is the money aspect. The reason why, which is odd to me, because you would think the reason why the games are so long, as we know, is maybe the 30-second commercials that air every 10 seconds or every minute and a half. So with every walk to the mound, it's just more commercials. So if you tell me that I'm going to be able to watch a baseball game with less commercials, then yes, by all means, give me a pitch clock. Let's cut down the walks to the mound. Let's cut down the warm-up pitches. I'm all for it.
Okay, I want to ask you about an existing rule, because it's been burning in my craw for years and years and years. I'm a little older than you, so I predate the designated hitter rule in the American League. I've never been a fan of it, because, like you said earlier, it changes the strategy of the game. That being said, it's been around for so long. I still don't understand why you have a major sporting league where one league has a rule that is different than the other. I would love to get rid of the designated hitter rule, but barring that, then you got to put it in the National League too.
You're right, because this is my take on this. If you're never going to get rid of it, obviously. I think we could both agree on that. And I think the reason why, and the obvious reason why you're never going to get rid of that, is because the players' union would not allow such a thing, only for the simple fact that if I'm a 40-year-old power hitter that can't play the outfield anymore, I could probably still get a 2 or 3 year deal swatting home runs or, you know, getting 400 bats a year as a DH in the American League. So that's really, I think, the only way you can look at that is you're right. Let's bring it to the National League as well. I don't like it at all how it's not an even, you know, even playing field. It's almost like in the pitch count, where in the American League the pitch is higher, that the strike zone is higher than it is in the National League. Why? I never understood that. Why is it different? I mean, is the park different? Are you telling me the dimensions are different in the park? That I don't understand why a strike would be different, higher or low, in two different leagues. So I think that's a couple things that are kind of strange.
Well, the grand old game of baseball will be the same as it has been for a couple of generations anyway when the 2017 season kicks off. But in 2018, I guess we're going to have to really, really watch out. Tony, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program to talk with us. Thank you for being on the show with us once again.
As always, Peter, I really appreciate it.
Sports expert Tony Cotillo. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is number 0394, and you'll find links to Tony's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you seen a new gas can lately? I'm talking about the kind you use to fill a lawnmower, chainsaw, leaf blower, or any small engine. All gas cans sold in the United States now are missing something that they've had for decades, a vent. That's right, a little vent on the opposite side of the can from the spout has always made it easier to pour gas, but not anymore. And because not having that vent makes it harder to fill a gas tank, it's causing a lot of people to, well, vent about it. A few years ago, the Environmental Protection Agency developed new regulations for gas cans to reduce spillage and eliminate vapors. To conform, gas can manufacturers had to eliminate the vent. Problem is, many consumers think the new cans are so hard to use, they wind up spilling more gas than before. Let's be fair, this isn't the first time a well-meaning government regulation has backfired. If you know of a similar story, tell us about it. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the comic book. It all comes to you here on The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the gig solution, finding job opportunities for baby boomers. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. And we have more Stuff File news here on a listener-supported program that needs your help to continue, survive, and thrive. Join us at patreon.com. And be part of the ride. Be part of Stuff File Nation. Well, 86-year-old Doris Payne was arrested once again for shoplifting, this time at an upscale mall in an Atlanta suburb in December. But according to a 2013 documentary, career-wise, she has stolen more than $2 million in jewelry from high-end shops around the world. No regrets, she said on the film, except I regret getting caught, said her California-based lawyer. Aside from her activities, she is a wonderful person with a lot of fun stories. Well, apparently she has some redeemable qualities. You know, at 86, I would tell Doris that perhaps it's time to retire her thieving ways. But if I were in the same room with her, she'd probably steal my watch. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And it kind of connects to retiring in a way, or maybe not, depending how you look at it. There may be high employment today, but you wouldn't know it by boomer standards. Many business professionals over 50 still struggle with long-term unemployment, underemployment, low pay, and traditional job search techniques that produce nothing. good reasons why more boomers are turning to the gig economy. What's that? Well, we talk about the gig economy with Spunk Burke, author of The Gig Solution. Spunk joins us on the line right now from Boston. Hi, Spunk.
Hi there, Peter. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you on the program. First of all, right off the bat, I got to ask you, your parents didn't name you Spunk, did they?
Peter, we do not want to go into this on your show.
Fair enough. Fair enough. What exactly is The Gig Solution? Besides being your book, obviously.
Well, it's an effort to share some information with boomers who are having a great deal of difficulty finding conventional employment. You know, we hear about labor statistics and full employment, but it doesn't really reflect the plight of people over the age of 50. I'm talking about business professionals, Peter, who over the age of 50, who happen to lose their job, have a very, very difficult time finding a comparable job. And so they may go months without being able to even be interviewed. And if they are lucky enough to land a job, it's typically underemployment, if you will. It's less of a job than they used to have, and certainly a lot less pay.
Is part of the problem mindset? And the reason I say that, there seems to be the younger generation and business sense today. You have people who don't look at business the way boomers did or the older generation, and that is you work for a company from the time you leave school, you stay with that company for whatever period of time you are working, and you retire from that company. Or at least you have a long-term plan with a company, whereas you have younger people today who don't see jobs as a permanent situation and will be more apt to go from job to job to job. Is that a mindset that boomers have to attain?
Well, I think we've been exposed to that mindset over the last decade. You don't find boomers coming out of 30-year positions anymore. They're more typically out of, they had a position 7 years ago, 5 years ago. In other words, this chronicness, if you will, of employment has been catching up to them. And now it's at a point where they're fortunate if they're able to maintain a conventional job for more than 2 or 3 years. So from a mindset standpoint, I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is twofold. One, they're overpaid, frankly. Boomers were overpaid in the rah-rah times of the 90s, and I think a lot of boomers say, look, I'm not budging on my price. This is what I want. And it takes a few months before the lesson sets in, but after some time, they appreciate they've got to be a little bit more flexible because there are younger people who are willing to do it for considerably less. So you got the price issue, and you also have, and dare I say it, the ageism issue. Now, age discrimination is against the law, but the fact of the matter is it occurs. It's prevalent, and boomers are not welcome if they're over the age of 50 in conventional, generally speaking, in conventional businesses, there's no room for them as an employee.
Okay, so we keep mentioning, and again, your book is called The Gig Solution. We keep mentioning gig. What types of things or what kind of work can be a gig?
Well, you and I have known gigs to be for years and years and years, typically associated with music. I've got a music gig. It might be creative. It might be web design. But the gig economy was a term coined by the Staffing Industry Analysts, which is a think tank group that follows the staffing industry. And they came up with the gig economy by expanding what a gig is. So now gigs include all manner of work that is short-term in nature, typically with an objective and a deliverable. And so that being the case, boomers who are business professionals for the first time can start considering looking for business gigs rather than conventional employment.
Are there business gigs that at one point used to be considered long-term jobs, but they have changed in structure and in definition?
Well, I guess I would argue that all long-term jobs, if you will, are nothing more than a series of gigs. But I don't know that gigs typically for business professionals who are boomers are very specific in terms of what they want accomplished, when they want it accomplished, and how much they're willing to pay for it. They're very discreet, Peter. And unfortunately, there's no job board or agency that boomers can go to and reliably expect that they're going to be introduced to gigs in the near future. They've really got to be self-sufficient and learn how to find their own gigs. And that was part of my mission in terms of writing the book.
Okay, well, you've written the book. You are a gig coach. What qualifies you to be such?
I've been in the staffing industry, contract staffing industry, since the early 70s. And I've put thousands and thousands of people to work in gigs. Admittedly, most of them were technical or professional, not really business gigs. This business gig arena has just recently surfaced. And I look at it as a step just beneath a consultant. This is more of a contracting gig. This is where business people go in, they help define an objective, they develop a strategy, some tactics, and they execute. This is all about implementation. And what I do is I urge my boomers to look at work in 10-week or 12-week segments, even if it's a 9-month gig. Break it up into segments, develop a project plan, present the plan, and get to work.
You know, the thing about baby boomers is just by nature of their age, they are closer to the retirement age than anybody who's younger. And, of course, one of the things about retirement is it's a lot of things people don't think about when they're young, even though they should. So how do you get a boomer past the mindset of, well, gosh, this is only going to last 10 weeks. I've got to think right now what I'm going to do when the 10 weeks is over. In other words, how do you get that stress level of what the future might hold or not hold when you're working from gig to gig to gig?
Well, things have changed, of course. You're not going to sign on for a conventional job that'll last another 10 years. It's just not going to happen. And I think most people are tuned into that fact. So if we're going to do gig work and we're going to do a gig a quarter, so that's 4 quarters a year, we're going to have to maintain some kind of marketing efforts that will sustain us and be able to line up gig after gig. The good news is, there's an abundance of work out there that needs to be done. That's where it's different from jobs. Jobs can be somewhat scarce for boomers, but gigs are abundant once you learn how and where to look for them.
I think that's something, that point you just made, is something a lot of people might not realize and may be the aha moment for a lot of folks, that you just mentioned the fact that there are gigs out there. Now, somebody who would pick up your book, The Gig Solution, what is the most important thing you feel they can take away from reading your book?
Well, the first thing, I don't know if this is the most important, but the first action that they have to take is to take an honest look at their past 10 years, not their whole career, the last 5 years, if you will, and look at what they've accomplished and see if it can't be packaged as a solution. Because these gig workers are no longer applicants. They're vendors. Their basic goal, their basic objective is to get into the marketplace, identify companies that have similar problems, and present themselves as a vendor with a solution. So there's a mindset change here, Peter, and it's significant. So these people don't go out and interview. They go out on appointments, and they present their solution. And the good news is that the prospect, the buyer, the person who in the old days we used to call the hiring authority, has a pretty easy decision to make. We're not talking about long-term marriages here. We're talking about bringing someone in with a project plan who can get the work done, get started immediately, and we know how much it's going to cost to start advancing on that objective. So it's an easier decision, so it happens more quickly.
Vital stuff indeed. How does one get their hands on your book, The Gig Solution?
Well, the book is being published next month in March, but they can go and register for to be on the list to know when it's coming out on my website, which is thegigsolution.com.
That's www.thegigsolution.com. Valuable information indeed. Thank you very much, Spunk, for being on the program with us.
Been a pleasure.
Spunk Burke, author of The Gig Solution. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is number 0394, and you'll find links to Spunk's site, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. I've got another Stuff File news story we have to share with you. And here's a classic case of failing to think through their crime. A group of men decided to snatch about $1,200 from the Eastside Grill's Tooth Jewelry Shop in St. Paul, Minnesota, in February. They fled, despite two of them having already provided ID and one having left a mold of his teeth. Wow. Not the brightest boys in the least. I had some thoughts of making them the idiot of the day, but I didn't. But they're really close, so let's just call them idiot adjacent. But now, boys and girls, this is indeed the moment you've all been waiting for, because it's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
42-year-old Jeff Little of Monroe, Washington, wrote in a mobile phone text, "Hey Shane, how's it going? You remember what you said that you would help me kill my wife? I'm going to take you up on that offer." For a bonus, he added, Shane should kill his 4-year-old daughter too. They'd split the life insurance on his wife, which is $1 million, and on his daughter, which is $500,000, when the job was done. Other messages included his and his wife's schedules and suggested he make it look like a robbery. The texts were to his former boss, who apparently isn't named Shane, and that former boss called the police. Little says he wrote the messages months ago to vent and didn't send them to anyone, but left them as drafts on his phone. He claims he doesn't know anyone named Shane, and maybe his daughter sent them. Little is being held on $1 million bail and charged with 2 counts of criminal solicitation for murder. Okay, why? Oh, why would you be so careless as to keep a draft copy of a text on your alleged murder-for-hire plot on your phone? And why would you then send said text to your former boss? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0394. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0394. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.